I am Platt on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. George Garrett died on Monday night. He was 89 years old. 89 years is a long time, but in George's case, I know so many people, friends and family alike, George himself, would have wanted just a little while longer. It's a testament to a life well lived that 89 years was not nearly enough. He filled those 89 years with a lot. His career in reporting at CKNW and at BCTV is legendary. Much has already been said over the last day or so in the media and social media of his career that yielded so many awards and accolades. Each one delighted and perhaps stunned the product of middle-of-nowhere Saskatchewan, who made his way west and made a life and career that remain the envy of so many. It is, one should note, a career that might not be possible today. It was cancer that hastened George's life. It's been a couple of years now since he was first diagnosed. He faced it, as he did his life and career, with dignity and enthusiasm, and as he taught us over the years how to live in his own inimitable way, he taught us how to contend with the specter of death, again with dignity, and he was gallant. Our mutual friend George Orr often describes Garrett as a gentleman. So many people have commented on his kindness as a reporter. His integrity is certainly oft mentioned. But what made George Garrett so likable and so good was because he was a gentleman and a gentleman. You saw that in the compassionate lens with which he saw life and the problems of our society and how he covered the good and the bad. And you certainly saw it in his family life, whether it's his marriage to Joan and the pride he took in his daughters Linda and Lori, their families, and all those grandchildren and great-grandchildren. He'd beam when he talked about all the Garretts, Fields, and Wattses. I think it's in Proverbs that mentions something, and I'll paraphrase here, a faithful man being abound in blessings. And George was faithful and blessed. And he always remembered his son, Ken. I still weep for George when I think of him imagining what sort of man he'd have turned out to be had he lived. I first met George Garrett 10 years ago, but it was as though I knew George Garrett my whole life, having grown up listening to CKNW. It was always time to perk one's ears up if at the top of the hour he was leading the newscast with something breaking, something exclusive, or both. It was through George Orr that I first met Garrett. Orr suggested I interview George on my podcast. It is because of both of the Georges' generosity that I am proud to have called each of them friend. When it was we three, other than lunch, great conversation was always served up. We'd alternately solve the world's problems, catch up on life, and remember what was necessary about the past. I remember fondly the funny stories and the lessons I learned, not just in diligence and hard work, but in kindness and decency. We all learned that. George Garrett's reverence for the value of family, faith, and friendship, his infinite curiosity, made him the peerless reporter he's been celebrated for throughout his career and long after. It's that same curiosity that made him look with wonder at the world as it's evolved over his nearly 90 years. I was asked over the last day or so what I would miss most about George. Those are myriad and unimportant, because what I'll miss for George is all the things he'll miss. Just after Christmas, he mentioned that he's expecting a third great-grandchild in the summer. He was particularly happy that Linda would be a grandmother. Despite the bleakness of the diagnosis from his doctors, I asked if he wanted to stick around for that. Without missing a beat, he said, "You bet." So I'll miss that for him. I know he'll have wanted to know how the Surrey police situation would turn out, and of course, the rest of this Canuck season. It was soon after his first interview with me on the show that he mentioned that he wanted to write his memoirs. I said it was a fantastic idea, and though I can't take credit for it coming into being, I was fortunate to read an early draft and honored that he asked for suggestions. The book became a bestseller, and George delighted in book signings and appearances with all the proceeds from sales benefiting the Volunteer Cancer Driver Society, an organization he helped found and was a staunch spokesperson for many years. It's one of the many charitable endeavors he supported. He always looked for a way to better the community, and that too involved getting involved politically. His endorsement, I know, meant a lot to the candidates and issues he supported. It's almost most as if, after a lifetime of reporting fairly and honestly, he was allowed to be a partisan. And it wasn't just loyalty that guided his views, it was a careful study of the issues. There is so much more to say about the life of George Garrett. I'll commend to those who haven't yet read his memoir, his book, Intrepid Reporter, which gives one a sense of the man and the many stories that filled his 89 years. I'll also suggest you listen to Eric Chapman's podcast, Eric's Living Room, which has at least one episode featuring George and the story of him infiltrating the towing business for a story. It is what I believe was George's last interview. And Eric did a great job adding color to George's reminiscences. Here now are some clips from conversations I had with George on this podcast. He appeared on the show 6 times. He often remarked, when asking as to who the latest guest on the show was, that he still had several more appearances until he reached the number of my most frequent guest, Rafe Mayer. You'll hear Garrett talking about the heights of his professional career as well as the personal. It's a great way to remember George. I'll remember him often and I'll miss him. But the best tribute is to be just a little bit like him. And just perhaps life will be a little bit better for you and those around you. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, George Garrett. Mr. Garrett, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Yourself?
Fine, thank you. I want to congratulate you going into another year of podcasts.
It's year 17. Yeah, it's a long time.
How many interviews?
Today you are 1841.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I just think it's wonderful. You've gained so much knowledge, and you've helped a lot of people.
Well,
you are well-read, sir. You have a few books.
Well, thank you very much.
I thought I was going to go up the corporate ladder, so I detoured out of news and I went into sales in the 60s, about 64, somewhere in there. And I thought I would go up that corporate ladder, and I was, at best, I guess, a mediocre salesman. NW was an easy sell because it was so popular, and it just killed the other stations. So we had a good product to sell. And I wasn't a bad salesman. I was just kind of average. And then I got an offer to go to Trail to manage the station there. And I really agonized over that because it meant moving my family to Trail. And my wife, Joan, was very supportive, and my children, of course, went with us. Linda, our oldest, was in university, so she couldn't, but the other two came. And they cried about leaving Surrey and Vancouver area. We'd been in Trail for about 4 or 5 months, and they said, "We love it here." And then I got fired in Trail. So we had to come back to the Vancouver market. And the best thing I ever did in my career was to phone my old boss, Warren Barker. And I said, "I've been fired, Warren, in Trail." And I remember his exact words. He said, "What? That's astonishing." He said, "Come and see me." So I did. And I almost get choked up when I say this, because I went into his office, and he opened with, "George, I can give you a job as a reporter at the best salary possible for a senior reporter. But if you'd like to go out and check with other radio stations or television or newspapers or whatever you want, you know you've got a job here." Well, I wasn't going anywhere else, you know.
Yeah.
As I say, I still get a bit emotional about it because it meant so much to me. And within a year or so, Warren gave me a kind of a free rein. He created something called Investigative Reporter. Well, I think all reporters have to be investigative. That's the name of the game. Find out what's going on and tell the people. But the difference it made for me was that I didn't have a specific assignment. Mm-hmm. I could go out and dig on my own. And it had kind of a double edge to it because it was the luxury of having the time to do it. But the panic sometimes of thinking, oh, I don't have a story. I've got to find one. So I listened to a lot of newscasts. I read a lot. And I made sure that I got around to all the places where news can be generated, courthouse being a mm-hmm. good example. And I always felt that it was far better to make eye-to-eye contact with someone as often as you could, as opposed to just phoning. It helps you when you do have to use the phone only, but there's no substitute for face-to-face, and people make a judgment of whether you're trustworthy, whether you're someone they want to talk to, whether you'll treat them fairly, and that's what worked for me over the years, mm-hmm. particularly with police. They're very distrustful of media generally, always have been. They have a little phrase they use to hide behind not telling you anything, and it's, oh, it's still under investigation. Well, I don't know how many times I heard that. And then I walk down the lane and talk to the detective working on the murder case and say, well, what's going on? Yeah. And he lay it out for me, of course.
Yeah. that's something that people have said about you. They use words like integrity, kindness, compassionate. So these are qualities that you have, obviously, and served you well as a reporter. Where did they come from? Was that something that you knew early on was important to be a successful? I don't know if you knew early on that you wanted to be a journalist, but just a successful person, you know, a citizen.
Well, I probably I came into the journalism part of it a bit accidentally. When I was a kid during World War II. I was with my aunt on a farm, and there was a battery radio there, and she worked for a hired man, a housekeeper she was called, and he was a tightwad, but he would only listen to the news on his battery radio at 12:30 every day during the war to find out what had happened overseas. And that got me into listening to radio, but he would take the clips off the battery after every newscast, that one newscast he listened to, so that I couldn't turn his radio on. And I got so interested in radio, say 1944, so I'm 10 years old, basically, and I thought, I want to be inside that radio. And I never lost that. And I started taking auditions and hanging around my hometown station, which was CHAB Moose Jaw, when I was about 15. Took my first audition at 15, and the guy said, well, you've got a pretty good voice, kid, but you're going to have to get more experience. But by hanging around the station, carrying remote equipment, running to get coffee for the guys, one guy was named Bruce McGinnis, great voice, he said, I know you want to get into radio, kid. He said, I know the chief announcer up in North Battleford. He said, why don't you go see him and tell him I sent you? So I hitchhiked up to North Battleford, which was 250 miles away. I couldn't afford a bus ticket. So I went into the station, met the chief announcer, and he said, I don't hire people. He said, you'd have to talk to the program director, whose name was Tommy Nelson. So I did get to talk to him. He's a guy with a brush cut, looked like a military guy, but the kindest man, as it turned out. And I just told him how badly I wanted to get into radio. I was a high school dropout, and I was 17 years old then, and he did hire me. And he told me later, he said, I didn't hire you because of your voice. I hired you because you showed that you really wanted this job by hitchhiking to come here. So he said, good luck. And he got me on my way. I subsequently got my life ambition to work at my hometown station, CHAB, mm-hmm. where I was befriended by a guy named Bob Giles, who was an outstanding broadcaster, who came out here to Vancouver. And I couldn't wait to come out and visit him. And his first words were, so when do you want to come to CKNW? And I said, oh, I don't know if I'm ready for this market. He said, go see Hal Davis. So Bob had put in a word for me. By this time, I'm 20 years old. And they didn't hire 20-year-olds at NW in those days. But Bob Giles had put in a good word for me. Hal Davis hired me. And I remember I was a cheeky kid. I was working in North Battleford at the time. I sent him a wire after he'd offered me $300 a month. I said, I need $350. So he wired back, sorry, $300 absolute tops. I wired back, accept. So I came out here in 56.
Did you miss reporting?
Oh, yes.
So when you hear a siren, do you have to hold yourself from chasing it, say?
Well, sometimes I drive by the scene of something. Uh-huh. And I guess about a year ago, there was another of the many homicides in Surrey. And I was coming back from the Y with my gym strip on. And I pulled over to see what was going on. And some people were there from the other media, and some of them knew me and all. We chatted a bit. And I saw a woman walking down the street, and I thought, that woman's a witness. So I called her, and I'm not even a reporter anymore, but I said, hi, what's happening? She said, oh, so-and-so in there, I think he was murdered. And I said, do you know who lives there? Oh, yeah. So she had quite a bit of information,
yeah,
which is no good to me.
Yeah.
But I quickly hailed Marcella Bernardo from NW, and I said, you may want to talk to this lady. And she was walking away. So I said, I called her by name, and I said, oh, do you mind just waiting a minute and talk to my friend Marcella? So she did, and Marcella got a story out of it.
Yeah.
So maybe I contributed in one small way, but Garrett, you're not doing stories anymore.
As I said in the introduction, for the Alzheimer's organization, mm-hmm, here, tell us about your experience with the disease. I know your wife has had it now for 5 years.
Now, she was diagnosed in 2010, you're mm-hmm, right. And I didn't realize it. And Joan and I had gone to visit friends in Kelowna. And before we got out of the driveway, apparently, she phoned one of my daughters, Lori, and said, Lori, what's wrong with your mom? And Lori said, what do you mean? She said, well, she's lost weight. She can't remember things. She doesn't really complete the conversation. Something's wrong. And I guess I'd noticed a few things, but, you know, when you're living with someone, you don't notice. It's like a child growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You don't notice the changes until, let's say, a relative comes to visit a year later and say, oh, look at Johnny, grown so much. Oh, has he? Maybe they're not the right analogy, but I didn't notice as much as I should have. And finally, both my daughters, Linda and Laurie, said, Dad, we better talk about it. So we had a meeting, and they said, we think we should have Mom checked for Alzheimer's or some form of dementia. And sure enough, we were referred to a specialist in White Rock, and the first visit, he confirmed that it's Alzheimer's disease. And I sure knew as the months went on. Joan would do some strange things like getting up and getting dressed in the middle of the night, wanting to go out. I had to have the lock in my front door changed, so no longer a toggle switch. I had to use a key and then hide the key. And once in a while she would say, I wish I could find the key to that door so I could get out. And I said, well, it's around here somewhere, knowing full well where I hid it. But those are the things you had to do. And one of them was she would look in a mirror, and she'd take a bar of soap and draw an X across the mirror. And she'd say, get that woman out of here. She spits at me. She hits me. She's looking at her own image. But in her mind, she's a little girl. She's not an adult. And I had to have a friend of mine help me cover the mirrors with black cloth for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And there were just so many things. It became impossible to care for her in a physical way. And so we did make an arrangement to have her go into what's called respite care 4 days at a time. And the first time I did that, I was so upset with myself, I went home and cried. I thought I'd betrayed my wife. And I phoned a few people, including professionals, and said how guilty I felt and should I go visit her. And some said, well, why don't you leave it for a day or two? But I couldn't wait. So the next morning, I went to see her in that facility. And she looked up when she saw me, and she said, well, look who's here. She had no animosity at all. Yeah. I thought she'd be terribly angry with me for putting her in there. But she wasn't. And so that eased the guilt a little bit. And then I guess as time went on, things got worse. And I spoke to Linda, my oldest daughter, and said, I guess we should try and get moved up on the list if you and Lori agree. And then she said, yes, we think so too. And just like that, we got an opening at this wonderful place where she is now. It's called Crossroads in Surrey, over by Fleetwood Community Center. And the three of us went in there for an interview, two daughters and me. And they said, yes, they would accept Joan. And I said, when would you like her? They said, tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. And I thought, my goodness, I've got to make a decision, like right now. So I said to the girls, shall we do it? They said, yes. So I picked her up from the temporary care place and drove her right to the new one, driving by our home, basically. She said, aren't we going home? I said, well, I found an even nicer place to stay, which it was.
Yeah.
And so the first day there was really difficult because when they do the entrance interview, I guess they call it, they do have to ask a lot of questions. Your age, your address, your wife's information, your family. So they asked about my family, and I gave them the names of the two girls. And they said, did you have a son? And of course, Ken died 27 years ago, and I wouldn't have brought it up, but the questioner did. And that just opened the floodgates for Joan.
She
started thinking about Ken. And she said, I can't handle this. And it was really difficult for all of us, but we got through it. And within a few days, I did take her out for lunch and brought her back. And I thought, this is going to be difficult getting her to come back into this care home. But I was wrong. She quite willingly went in.
Yeah.
And even now, once in a while, she'll say, we should go home. And I'll say, well, this is a nice home too, isn't it? Well, yes.
Yeah.
And she can converse a little bit, not much. You know, she still knows my name, but not her daughter's.
So what's the toll like for you, for your family? Because, I mean, it's incalculable for me to understand what that must be like.
It's the initial shock of going through that. We were married in 56, rather. So my radio career kind of paralleled the time I was married. And it's coming up 58 years this year. And it's been a love story right from day one. And to see your loved one afflicted by this is really very difficult. It does come on in stages. You know, the realization sets in that things are not going to change. There's not much you can do about it except to care for her, make sure that she's getting the right care, which she is. And when I go to the home, I always give her a kiss. The other day I said, did you like that? And she said, not really. But once in a while, we can be quite, we can talk a little bit. I have difficulty understanding what she's saying. And I bought her a present for Christmas. I thought, I can't buy her jewelry. I can't buy her clothing. She's got lots of clothing. What can I get her? So I bought her a stuffed animal, little rabbit, and then I bought her a little puppy. And those are the things that she likes. She clutches them in her wheelchair. And one of the things that happened at the rest home was that when she first went in there, she'd walk the halls. They were free to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She loved to walk. And then I noticed they gave her a frame or to walk with. And I said, why do we have to have the frame? Well, because we're afraid that Joan will fall. And within a matter of weeks, she's in a wheelchair. And I said, how did that happen? She just can't get up. She refuses to stand up. She's either afraid or her brain will not tell her how to do it. So ever since, she's been in a wheelchair. I got her the best one I could get, but it's still a wheelchair. And it hurts to see her in it, but that's the way it is.
You also talk in the book about this childhood of yours. I mean, it's a humble childhood. The prairies, in the dirty 30s. I mean, it's not an altogether pleasant and place,
no,
was it?
My mom and dad had a pretty tough time. My dad was an honest workman. He was a laborer, a farmer, and he loved the farm. He'd do anything to be out on the farm, but he found he had to leave because we were running a farm for a rather parsimonious gentleman who didn't provide too much, so my dad had to move our family to a nearby town called Chaplin. But along with the poverty aspects, we were no different than most farmers in the area in the 30s. But my mother had what was used to be called a nervous breakdown. It occurred after the birth of my older brother, Bob, and she had some very difficult times. And I do remember her actually picking up a can of gopher poison and intending to drink it, and my dad intervened and prevented that. So I think that was when the decision was made that she had to go to an institution in Brandon. And her parents lived not too far from there. So my older brother and sister were taken with Mom to live with grandparents in Manitoba, but my dad wouldn't let me go. And at times my siblings called me Dad's pet. He was very, very gentle with me. And we eventually, you know, we came out of it. The war came along. There were more jobs and so on. And he eventually got a pretty good job.
And the book lovingly recounts what it was like on the prairies at that era. And then you talk about heading west. The one thing that I was surprised about, I mean, you're beloved in this community. The police trust you, judges, and everybody else. But growing up, I mean, because it was so desperate, I mean, it could have turned out very different for you, right?
I was just on the edge, you know, of being involved in not so much the wrong kind of people, but just the wrong end of the economic spectrum. And I remember we had a car, a buddy and I named Willie. We owned an old car that I got from my brother, but we kept running out of money and running out of gas, so we thought, well, we can steal some gas from one of these big transport trucks. They won't miss it. So we were, I recall the picture, and I'm thinking the listener would say, oh, George, you didn't do that. Mm-hmm. But I'm smoking. We're hanging out near the pool room in town on the most notorious street in Moose Jaw, which is called River Street. And we're waiting for it to get dark so we can go out and steal gas. Along comes a policeman whom we knew, named Scotty Goodman. What are you doing tonight, boys? Oh, nothing, Scotty. He shines his flashlight in the back of the car. We don't have a trunk. We just have a floor in the back. And he said, if you're going out to steal gas, you'll need a bigger jug than that. So I was elected by my buddy to be the guy that sucked on the gas hose. Uh-huh. Never, ever again.
Yeah.
It's a horrible taste.
Yeah.
But that was one incident, you know, that was the wrong side of the law, really.
And then there was another moment in the book, you talk about it. I mean, it's almost a turning point where you saw a guy's wallet. The guy's passed out drunk.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I would call it a crime of opportunity, or it could have been.
Yeah.
I passed by, I was renting a hotel room one night in Calgary. I'd hitchhiked there. That was my mode of transport always.
Yeah.
You know, stick out my thumb. I was staying at this hotel and walking back to my room, and I saw a door open, glanced in, and there's a man passed out with his trousers on the chair a few feet from me. And I thought, I'm going to steal the money out of his wallet. Like, unbelievable. I'm just not criminal-minded.
Yeah.
But I even picked up a beer bottle in case
he
woke up.
Yeah.
You know? And somewhere in that moment, I thought, this is wrong. I put down the bottle, I quietly closed the door, and went back to my own room. And the next morning, I was hitchhiking as usual, and I got a ride with a fellow who happened to be a Mormon, a truck driver. And we got talking about it, and it occurred to me then that it was divine intervention that stopped me from doing something that probably would have led to a life of crime. And as I say in the next chapter in the book, it was a turning point in my life, and I mention it. I'm very embarrassed about it, but I mention it because it's significant. After that, I got breaks, and I started, you know, I got a job in radio. First as an announcer, a disc jockey, and then ultimately as a newsman. And thank goodness those things turned out that way.
I mean, just imagine. I mean, it'd be a very different book today.
It would be, written from inside the cell.
In the end of the book, you talk about the nostalgia around the golden age of radio, and you say that that era has passed. But, you know, I look around the city and the various media outlets that I rely on. I mean, it's there still at CKNW. It's there at Global and everywhere else in the city. And I guess that model is that, I mean, you could trace that back to Warren Barker, I mean, for whom you dedicate this book.
Yes. Warren was my news director. He was an outstanding man. He gave me a lot of freedom after I'd left the station for a short time to be manager up in Trail, which lasted 5 months. Mm-hmm. I came back and worked the beat again, and he came up with the idea of the intrepid reporter, which really means a reporter who is self-assigned. So he called me an investigative reporter. Of course, I think all reporters are investigative, but
right.
He gave me the time to just do what I wanted. I didn't have to follow an assignment list, which was a great luxury. It also had the reverse effect of putting pressure on myself that I have to have a story to merit being given all this time. And I would go fallow for a long time, and I would, you know, infringe on some of the stories our own reporters were doing. But some didn't like it. But I wanted a story every day or several times a day if I could get it. But having the time to do investigative work, like I did a little gimmick with got a job as a tow truck driver and that kind of thing.
Right.
And infiltrated a meeting at the government house in Victoria. Not really great stories, but interesting.
Yeah.
My ambition over the years has always been to tell a story, and that's hopefully what I did in the book.
And that's what you write in the book, that's how you want to be remembered, you're the guy who loved to break stories.
Absolutely. And if I could beat the other guy, that's great. But there's another facet to it, too. You know, during my early years, I was very unprepared to do an interview or to go to a news conference involving Field Marshal Viscount Montgomery.
Monty, yeah.
Monty, famous World War II man.
Yeah.
And I did not take the time, even though I was new to the area, I didn't take the time to find out how to get to this place. And it was at a Lieutenant Governor's residence on the UBC campus.
Right.
And there is a Northwest Marine Drive and there's a Southwest Marine Drive. One of them is a garbage dump and the other one has the residence.
Yeah.
I got totally lost. Before pagers, before cell phones, I didn't know what to do. I asked at the garbage dump, I said, I have this address, where is it? And he said, it's around the point on Northwest Marine Drive, not Southwest. So when I got there, just in time to hear this cultured English voice saying, thank you, gentlemen, goodbye. And I was totally out of it. I missed the entire news conference. I had to phone my boss, Jim Cox, who was had a temper. And he let me have it, I'll tell you. And I deserved it. And I expected to be fired. But nothing happened, so I just went on with the next story and so on. And I think maybe that taught me then that if you have a problem, or you see a reporter has a problem arriving late for something, and we've all had the same information, like a news conference, why not loan them your tape? You've already used it on the air. You've had your, you know, not necessarily a scoop, but you've had it on the air. So give it to the next guy or gal. And apparently I became known for that I was willing to help other reporters, which was great.
That's what Steve Luce in the book writes. Mm-hmm. And again, this goes back to journalism in this town. He said that those values have stayed with him, and he's taken them to the CBC where he's at today.
He's the executive news director now. I'm very proud of him.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people in the media today who will say that I have had some influence on their career. Mike Clark was one of them. And one of the reporters, Jordan Armstrong from Global. And, you know, he was on the desk, and he asked to be set back out on the beat because that's what he likes doing. And he turned an interesting story into a terrific story, and it was the one about transit are using something to make it impossible for pigeons to conceive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, giving them birth control. Yeah.
Birth control. He wrote it so well. And I take my hat off to him. You know, that's an example, I think, of creative journalism and good reporter. There's lots of those people around. And Sam Cooper has done a fantastic job.
Oh, with the money laundering?
Money yeah. laundering.
The casinos?
Yes.
I'm sure a lot of people come up to you and look at your life and your career and admire it, obviously, and would like it for themselves. Is journalism something that you encourage people to?
Oh, absolutely. I can't think of a better career. I've often thought you should be in journalism with all your knowledge. My goodness. To me, it's a very fulfilling kind of work because you are getting satisfaction out of bringing information to the public. The guys in the Bureau in Victoria have done a wonderful job telling the story of shocking stuff that came out of the speaker's report.
Right.
And now the answer from the two gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I was shocked when they were walked out of the legislature. They chose to leave that way. They were offered the back door, but they chose to go publicly. But shocked at some of the things. And then when you see some of the explanations, so there's right. always two sides to a story. So we should wait and find out. They should have some kind of an inquiry into it. I know that the Auditor General is looking at it. So
I could talk all day with you about this book. There's so many things in this book, and I urge people to pick it up. I want to end on this, George. About a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now, with George Orr's screening of the film Talk. That was downtown, and it was a great turnout. Warren Barker was there, and a lot of the TV guys like Eric Rankin and John Daly and Sherelle Tobin from the CBC, and even radio, a lot of old radio guys, you know, like Doc Harris was there, and some other great writers like Lynn McNamara. You were there with your friend Walter, who's since passed away, mm-hmm. and you guys were leaving, and so I said, well, we'll walk out with you. And there were about two or three radio guys standing on House Street there, milling about. I don't know their names. I think I do know their names, but I don't want to misattribute this to anybody. So, but they're guys that you would see, say, at that lunch that Red Robinson puts on regularly. Mm-hmm. And so they were standing there, and as you passed them, you said, thanks, guys, for coming. And then one of them, you didn't hear this, one of them said, no, thank you, George, thank you for everything. Mm. And I thought it was just such a warm and sincere sentiment, especially since you were a part of that film. He didn't just mean that day in that screening, because George Orr was the one who put all that together. But I bring that up because I think that's how a lot of people think about you. I certainly do. I mean, you know, I've known you now for 4 years, and you know, you're one of my close friends. I guess I bring that up because I hope you know that there are a lot of people in this town who have that regard for you.
I do feel it, and I recall a comment that was written by Denny Boyd when I won the Jack Webster Lifetime Achievement Award.
The Bruce Hutcheson, yeah.
Bruce Hutcheson Award.
Yeah.
And Denny was quite a writer, and he said, George appears to have no ego. And for that, Bruce Hutcheson, Jack Webster, and all of us are grateful. Well, my pleasure, and thank you for giving exposure not only to me, but to other people who still have some stories to tell.